Hey, this is Uncle Bear with the Security Today podcast. I wanted to take a second to say that this episode is a little bit explicit. We talk about school shootings, data that goes into it, and some things get described. So it could be a little triggering if you've been affected by a school shooting or if you're sensitive to the topic. Thanks. Welcome to the Security Today podcast. I'm your host, Uncle Bear, and we're back at it again for another episode of The Room Where It Happens. This podcast is brought to you by Sprinter Business Solutions, so you can check them out at SprinterIT.com or at SprinterDataCom on Instagram. And we're going to get into it today again with David. It's Reedman, right?
Reedman, that's correct.
Reedman, awesome. Yeah, so David is somebody that I follow on Instagram and I follow on Substack. He's been doing it for quite a while, but he reports on statistics and kind of the reportings around the K through 12 school shooting database that he runs. And so I'll let him introduce himself here, but I wanted to get him on because, number one, I'm fascinated with the work that he does. I love the theory side of things. I love digging into the meat and trying to find solutions based on what we know. And turns out we actually know a lot, even though it seems to be recycled in the media, the kind of the same story. So, but I also wanted to get him in front of some of you guys, the listeners, because we need to be thinking about this from all aspects. And people like David are a huge asset to this topic. And as we're putting security into places and as we are thinking from a security mindset when dealing with schools, places where, you know, minors and children are, so not just schools, but outside of that as well, we need to be factoring in as much as we can because we're kind of the front lines of this when it comes to putting in and implementing things that will help and aid in, you know, progressing into the future and kind of dealing with this problem. A very complicated problem. I've talked on it multiple times on the podcast and our news and highlights addressed the issues and how it's a kind of an onion layered thing. But I definitely wanted to get David on here. I want you to be following his Substack and be following him on his social media. We'll get to all that. Sorry, I'm getting overexcited here. But yeah, David, why don't you go ahead and just introduce yourself a little bit, and then maybe you can start out and tell us kind of what you do on the day-to-day basis so that we kind of have some baseline to start from.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me. And I'm really an accidental school shooting researcher. I never intended to be in this. This was not the field that I picked. My entire career was in Homeland Security and emergency management. And it started during Hurricane Katrina. I was down there in New Orleans just a couple days after the storm. After that, I worked as a contractor in pretty much every capacity across DHS and FEMA, in national planning and preparedness, working in a watch center, working on counterterrorism, on technology projects. And I'd done all of that. I had a master's degree in Homeland Security Affairs. And in 2018, I was in a think tank program at the Naval Postgraduate School that was looking at what's the next generation of Homeland Security issues. What do we need to be thinking about in 10 and 20 years? And in the midst of that program, the Parkland shooting happened. So I'm sitting in a classroom watching the news about Parkland and realizing that in more than almost 15 years of emergency planning and Homeland Security planning, we had never talked about school shootings. Mm-hmm. I have been to dozens of briefings about the Boston Marathon bombing, you know, where two people died. And this is 17 people being killed in the school. And in that moment, right when Parkland happened, if you wanted to know how many shootings at schools happened that year, there wasn't any information. Why they were happening, the who, what, where, when, why. When did they start? Were they getting worse? Was it a trend that was going in a different direction? So I was really interested in how you could apply threat assessment tools from the Homeland Security world to identify a potential school shooter. But you can't do that unless you know who that is and it, or how it's changing or how it's evolving. So this started as just an internal class project to try to get the baseline of this is how many school shootings have happened and why and where. And then from there, it's just grown over the last 6 years into a public database, a public website that I run that is every shooting incident that occurs on a school campus for any reason. So it started as planned attacks, thinking about stopping Parkland. It's turned into capturing this holistic picture of gun violence on school property for now almost a 60-year time period from 1966 to present.
Yeah, and your data, and you can go to your Substack and see that timeline and those sorts of things. You've displayed it very well. And so, yeah, thank you for taking kind of up this cross to bear, because it's, I'm sure it's like led to a lot of heavy nights and sleepless, you know, trying to figure out what the problem is, or seeing it, or being so upfront and face first in the information. So yeah, you started in disaster reservist for FEMA. Can you kind of tell me just how you got into that, and maybe what that work looked like before maybe the Parkland happened, or I don't know, was Parkland, did that happen while you were that disaster reservist?
Yeah, so when I turned 16, I'd always been interested in emergency management and emergency response. I joined the local volunteer fire department as soon as I could when I was 16. That was a passion that I kept up as long as I lived in Maryland. But you know, once I moved around, went to some different schools, got into a graduate program, got into a postgraduate program, got into the first PhD program, I was really more interested in broader policy. So I worked at FEMA. You know, everybody in the Homeland Security world, or the emergency management world, knows ICS and NIMS, the Incident Command System, the National Incident Management System. You've got to take those trainings every year. And what does it all really mean? In 2008, I was actually on the team that went out to local jurisdictions to tell people about why this was important, about why we needed standardized procedures, why you need to have the same names for different resources in different jurisdictions. Because it's actually really depressing that when you read the DOJ report on Uvalde, a lot of the same things that were cited in 9/11 and in Hurricane Katrina were the same sorts of things that happened in Uvalde. Nobody took charge. The people who would have taken charge hadn't kept up on the training. People in the department didn't have clear procedures. There wasn't a unified command. There wasn't a common operating picture. People didn't understand different priorities across different agencies. And that's just been this theme that's happened across so many major incidents in our country. But I've been working, you know, now for 20 years to try to standardize information, to try to standardize terminology, to try to train people for how to work together during complex incidents. And I hope that this information, that's what my goal of collecting this information is, to improve the way that people train and respond.
Yeah, definitely. I think that those are interesting parallels and connection points to some other extreme disasters that have, you know, befallen our country. And so, yeah, interesting. I didn't connect that. I hadn't read that in your works yet, but that's something to think on. So, you worked for FEMA, and then I also wanted to touch just a little bit from a security standpoint, because I know that in the industry, Booz Allen is pretty well known. And so I saw that you had worked for them as well. And then also in the DC area, advising and consulting. Can you just expand on a little bit of what that experience was like?
Yeah, that was where you're one at? Of my first jobs out of college was as a consultant for Booz Allen. And Booz Allen had a contract with FEMA to write the first set of integrated national plans for every type of emergency. So I was working on the first federal interagency plan for a hurricane, an earthquake, a pandemic flu, which we were working on that in 2010. I don't think anybody took the plan out, you know, a decade later. One for no notice incidents in the Capital Region, because you have 26 different jurisdictions that are all going to be responding if you have something that happens in DC. So you need to have integrated plans for the way that they're going to work together. So yeah, I was at Booz Allen for a couple of years, and then I had an opportunity to take a job as the Homeland Security Advisor for the downtown DC Business Improvement District. And that's an area that's right between the White House and the Capitol that at that time, pre-COVID, was really a thriving business district. It's about 600 different commercial buildings that all work together on the advancement of that neighborhood. So I was there mainly working on a technology integration project. So we had a Homeland Security grant to try to get everybody's security cameras that were in the public spaces in and around these commercial buildings all integrated into a single network so that they could be monitored in real time by the DC Police Department. Because this is, you know, around 2012, the Boston Marathon bombing had just happened. And the only way that they were able to identify the bombers was by piecing together the little bits of surveillance footage from a couple different commercial buildings, from some ATMs. And we thought about in that moment, if this same thing happened in Washington, D.C., there's no assurance that you'd be able to get that kind of footage, because you don't know if the jewelry store is monitoring in real time. You don't know if this camera's working, if it's broken, if it's being, you know, dumped every 4 hours. So we wanted to get everybody onto one comprehensive network, which would be backed up locally. And then when there were appropriate circumstances, DC police would be able to access it.
Yeah, that's hard and holy work, if you will.
This is 2012. So, you know, everything's digital now and it's cheap now. But even looking back 10 years ago, probably half of the businesses still had analog systems.
Right.
And so it was an integration nightmare.
Yeah, I could imagine. And, you know, that kind of harkens to something that I try to project on the podcast often, which is that we're trying to stay right of bang, or left of bang. Sorry. And so that bang being that event, your whole career has kind of resided in, you know, building up that left of bang so that the preparedness and the emergency response and the incident response is all in place so that when it does happen, there's something to fall back on and they're not just scrambling, even though it seems that maybe if there is something to fall back on, they still scramble. But so have you grown that passion in maybe that emergency response or that planning? Because I can feel the passion in your work, and it does feel like you are passionate about that planning period for training, like you said, collecting that information so that it is there to fall back on. Did you have that, you know, in the early days? Like you said, you were volunteering for the fire department and stayed there for many years.
You see it in all of these circumstances. It can be a very isolated incident where it's somebody's house that burns down and they lose everything because they didn't take really basic precautions, like making sure the candles were blown out or having, you know, the fire alarm. So just this tiny bit of effort and education can keep somebody's life from being completely ruined or even lost in a house fire. You know, seeing Hurricane Katrina, seeing the amount of damage when there's water up to the roof line of people's houses across an entire city, as far as you can see in every direction. And you realize that putting a little bit more effort in ahead of this can prevent you from having to deal with this enormous consequence afterwards. And then that's really the situation when there's a shooting at a school, whether it's one kid that's shot in the hallway or whether it's 34 people shot at Parkland. Once somebody's there with a gun, once somebody fires a gun, it's too late for, at a minimum, the first victims, but probably for some subsequent victims as well. And there are warning signs, there are opportunities for prevention, there are opportunities for that person never to make their way onto the campus with the gun. And putting that time and effort into stopping something before it turns into a terrible situation is really this opportunity that we have that we're just missing in so many different situations, whether it's a house fire, natural disaster, or a mass shooting.
Can you speak a little bit to those warning signs? I mean, you've looked at data for years at this point. So what are some of those warning signs that maybe the data has even shown you, let alone just seeing it on TV and them reporting on it?
Yeah, there are two different circumstances that get lumped together, and I collect both of them. One is deliberate planned attacks at schools, which is a pre-planned attack where somebody is there with the intent to harm as many people as possible. And that has happened about 220 times since the 1960s. The much more common situation is somebody who's a habitual gun carrier, and at some point they get into a fight with someone in the school hallway or parking lot or cafeteria or at the football game, and then they pull a gun out during that argument. That turns into shots fired. Sometimes bystanders are hurt. But that was a person that didn't plan to shoot anyone that day, but the circumstances turned into a shooting. And from that kind of either branch, there are a lot of different prevention opportunities. Speaking first about, you know, the habitual gun carriers, that means that every single day there is an opportunity to catch the kid with a gun, for a community member or a parent to check their backpack, to check the house, for a violence interruption program, for education, for conflict resolution, for a metal detector. There you have dozens of different layers that can make sure that a habitual gun carrier doesn't turn into a situation where a kid opens fire in the hallway and probably hits a completely random kid who's there in the hallway. On the other circumstance with the planned attacks, these are planned for weeks, months, even years before the shooting happens. And when there's that amount of time, and they're usually involving young teenagers between 13 and 19, they tell multiple other people about the plot. They need to collect weapons, they draw plans, they make veiled threats, sometimes they recruit other people, but they're talking, and it can be in person, in private student spaces like bathrooms or gym class or the cafeteria or the school bus, or in a lot of group chats, Discord, things where your adult threat assessment team doesn't have any access to those conversations. And the only way to get that information is for somebody involved to say, there's a problem here, I'm going to tell an adult, and then that adult is going to take meaningful action. So with a planned attack, it's planned for a long time, and they talk about it as they're planning. That's an opportunity for intervention. A habitual gun carrier is carrying a gun for a long time. That's an opportunity for education and intervention. And every time a shot's fired, there's almost always been a failure to do one of those.
Mm. So you're saying, though, that the cases that get reported often are those drawn-up plans that have been happening, but it's much more common that it's a habitual gun carrier, that these teens or I guess college, that they've been carrying guns on campus for an extended period of time.
Yeah, last year there were almost 350 shootings at K through 12 schools. And just a couple of those, just three or four, fall into that deliberate pre-planned attack category. Almost all of the others are fights that are escalating into shootings. They most often happen at lunchtime, dismissal, or at sporting events. There were 40 shootings at high school football games last year, and they were almost all escalations of disputes, and it turns into a shooting because somebody's armed. And then you've got thousands of people at the football game that hear shots. Everybody's been trained and conditioned to think an active shooter is here. So then you've got the entire crowd at the football field running, jumping out of bleachers, jumping over the fences, and it's absolute chaos. So you can have these very small, isolated incidents that involve somebody who didn't plan to fire their gun at all that end up impacting thousands of people.
Yeah, that is something that I feel we don't often think about as the security integrator or the security technician as much. I mean, we're usually prone to the news and what they report. And then if it's not your local school in your district or nearby or a friend's kid, you know, that lives across the states, then we don't tend to think about it. But if we can start thinking about it, and this is one of the reasons that I definitely wanted to have you on, because I wanted this to start to form a conversation within people's heads as they're listening to think about, okay, even in that scenario where a dispute would rise and a gunshot would go off at like a football game, and then you would get people running, you know, then you start to think of exit plans. You start to think of barriers and barricades and what those are preventing and also what those are maybe causing in an issue like that. And so that is definitely something that I would hope people keep at the front of mind when they're designing this security at the front end, if it's on the prints or if they're working with the architect, or if they're putting security in as their integrator, you know. So excellent.
Yeah. With cameras, I mean, I think they're a really important tool, both for your situational awareness to figure out whether you have a deliberate attack or whether, you know, you have somebody that fired shots during a fight and they've fled. Most often when somebody fires shots during a fight, they're not going to stick around. They immediately flee. So you no longer have a threat that's right there at the school. But when somebody's an integrator, the client probably is paying a lot of attention about their cameras in the schools, their cameras in the hallways, the entryway. But 70% of the shootings in the last 10 years are outside of the school building. And most often they're at the front of the building. They're on a side, which is opening up to common areas of congregation, like your parking lots, your bus pickup line, your parent pickup line, or around the athletic fields. And so how many schools are paying as much attention to their exterior cameras and their exterior camera coverage, especially farther out in a parking lot? You know, they might have a camera that's by a door that has a view of the parking lot. Well, are they going to be able to tell who fired shots in the back row of that parking lot? Because if you have a shooting that involves a bunch of students at dismissal and the shooter flees and you haven't been able to identify them, are you going to reopen the campus the next day? If that person that was involved in the shooting, or maybe all the people that were involved in the fight that escalated into the shooting, if you can't identify them, you could have a subsequent issue the next day at school. So now are you not able to reopen for a day or a week because of the police investigation, because you didn't have any good CCTV footage to provide that evidence where you could immediately say, we know exactly who that person is, and, you know, we're going to go go make an arrest, whatever else. The amount of disruption that people have because they don't have evidence ends up having a long-term impact on the school.
Yeah, excellent point. And I can tell you right now, like, even dealing with schools, I've turned in, I haven't in a while, but I've turned in security prints, security drawings, and when they want to eliminate, they usually keep cameras within the school, but they usually go, well, we don't need to see this side of the building from both angles. You know, one angle's fine. That's just a field over there. So that is definitely something to think of. So these days, so moving on with some of the framework of this segment. So these days, you're working on the K-12 district. Do you kind of want to talk about that, your Substack, a little bit, and then maybe where they can find it, and tell us a little bit about also the Violence Project, which I saw on your LinkedIn, if you could elaborate on that as well.
Yeah, so the school shooting database is a public database with a website, k12ssdb.org. You can see a ton of data visualizations on there, all the news links. There's actually a brand new interactive dashboard that is hopefully launching early next week. So that's something where anybody can look and move around a lot of different variables to understand these incidents. But beyond that, I've really expanded this in the last couple of years to also look at threats, swatting, averted shooting, guns found in schools, stabbings in schools. So you can get this entire picture of what's happening on and around school property. I'm also a board member of the Violence Prevention Project at Hamline University. And that is a multi-pronged research center that's focused on reducing violence in public spaces. So there's a study of mass public shooters who've killed four or more people in public spaces with their life history. So all of these different variables about their experience, their education, abuse that they had, problems at home, criminal history, whatever else. And that comes from interviews with the perpetrators, if they're alive, interviews with their family members, writings, talking to neighbors, teachers, coworkers. So generally, gun violence prevention is just such a large effort that doesn't get any federal funding that you have to find these little niches. So I try to find every shooting that occurs on school property, because that's a manageable thing that one person tries to do. The Violence Project tries to understand the in-depth life histories of mass shooters and what are the commonalities between them. And then we collaborate on some broader projects around understanding school shooting threats. We looked at more than 3,000 school shooting threats over a three-year period to figure out the characteristics. I'm working on a project now, which is a study of 125 averted school shooting plots, and not to know why or why that person wanted to commit the shooting, but rather about how they were caught, how the plot was detected. So I'm just working on really a wide array of research, and it's all focused on prevention, having a better response, having a more effective response, and making sure that the things we're doing, the technology we're purchasing, the response plans that we have are addressing the actual circumstances based on now thousands of these incidents.
That is a ton of excellent information and data and research that people need. Now, you said that it doesn't often get federally funded. Is there a reason for that? Or
yeah, it goes back to since the 1990s. There's been a ban on federal funding going to really anything related to gun violence research.
That seems interesting. Okay.
That's a separate show of its own.
Yeah. That's another, we'll get into that next time, I guess. So then with all of this data and research that you're able to pull in and some of the projects that you're working on, some of the projects that you're assisting, what have you seen, or how do you see this data kind of get mold and built together so that it's creating policies? Like, what's the next step after you have this bulk of data that you've been working on?
Yeah, so it goes a couple different directions. So once you make data available and standardized and public, other people can combine it with the information they know and write new and novel research. So there are now about 700 different papers on Google Scholar that people have used this information to combine it with economics or public health, security, whatever else, whatever your field is, you can compare this to your research interest, and it's a ready-made thesis or dissertation or research paper right there. On the policy side, state-level legislators who are looking at different things, whether it's funding, whether it's changing the requirements for different personnel, arming other staff, fortifying buildings, funding crisis intervention, fighting threat assessment, whatever else, they use this information, and when they're giving testimony or briefing bills, this is the information that gets referenced. Tennessee, after the Covenant school shooting a couple of years ago, the governor ordered the comptroller's office to write a report on the characteristics of shootings at schools in Tennessee. So they came to me, the comptroller's office was able to filter this for the Tennessee information, and they put it into a public report that was, you know, released to everyone from the comptroller's office there. So that's the way that this information could be used at the state level, at the local level, at the federal level. There was a gun violence roundtable that some congressional folks held a couple weeks ago, and they used this as the starting point for a lot of their discussions around school safety.
Mm, okay. And then, awesome. So, okay, let's shift a little bit then from maybe what policy it turns into to the things that you've seen from the planning and the preparation side of things. I feel like since it's kind of got an uptick in the last, decade or two about school shootings, now you're seeing these responses from people who are providing training to the teachers or training to the staff. You're seeing, these preparations and trainings in admin offices that they're kind of like building and handing down to the schools in their district. What's your take on the training and planning side of what we're doing now, and maybe where we're getting it right and maybe where we're getting it wrong?
Yeah, that's been one of the huge findings, which I really didn't expect, but you don't know until you get into this information. And I meet with police and fire officials. I hold training sessions. I was doing a training workshop out with a regional police fire group this week. active shooter is a term that was created around 2007 or 2008. Nobody really knows what it means. There are a bunch of different definitions. Definitions used by DOJ and the Secret Service are completely different. But once you look at these deliberate attacks, they're not all the same. So if you have one active shooter plan, your deliberate attack could be an insider attack by a student. So they're allowed to be inside. They're allowed to carry a bag in. Maybe they're allowed to be there before the school opens or be there late in the afternoon. They might have an access card and access to the building, but they're going to know the facility really well. They're going to know the facility's procedures really well. And the most common type of deliberate attack is by a current student at the school, and it starts as a surprise attack inside the building. That's completely different from a situation like Uvalde or the Covenant School, where you have a former student who's not allowed to be there, hasn't been in that building for a little while, they don't have an access card, but they're going to be heavily armed and they're going to fight their way inside. And looking at the military terminology, that'd be a frontal assault on a target. We got to fight our way in there. And from a security planning standpoint, from a security kind of fortification standpoint, and from a first responders planning and preparedness, an insider attack that's a surprise is going to require a completely different set of trainings and strategies than a person who's running through the parking lot wearing a plate carrier and helmet with a rifle. I've actually found that there are 7 different types of attacks. There's that single shooter insider, there's a multiple shooter insider, frontal assault, a sniper, somebody who's there to take hostages, somebody who's ambushing specific people at a specific place because a school is dictated by time and location. We know that the lunch bell rings at 11:50 every day. So if I want to ambush this group, I know they're coming out of the doors of the cafeteria at 11:51 every single day. There's also people that have barricaded in schools for as long as possible without the intent to take hostages or go anywhere else. They're not active. They're in one room, but they're armed to try to stay there as long as possible. And then finally, complex coordinated plots. And that's either merging multiple tactics, using things like fire, explosives, chemicals, and weapons, or knowing the school's security procedures, doing something that causes a reaction in those security procedures, like pulling a fire alarm, knowing the students are going to evacuate this way, and then you're going to ambush them when they're leaving the school. Mm. So those things, all 7 of those, require different training, different terminology, different response plan. A bulletproof chalkboard might help you against a sniper attack, but it might be a tool that an insider, that student, who knows, I have this bulletproof chalkboard on wheels. They now have a shield that they can roll down the hallway if they're going from classroom to classroom. So if we just use one term, if we just use the term school shooting, we lose this wide array of different circumstances. And then within that, if we just use active shooter, then we're overlooking that it's 7 different things that need completely different responses.
Yeah, and if we lose those dynamics or that layered onion of trying to define what an active shooter is, we probably lose lives at that point when we're just trying to approach it from one standpoint. Do you feel as if the training that has kind of come up in the last decade is starting to see it this way? Or is it still a very one-viewed approach at school shootings?
Yeah, I think it's very one-dimensional. And when you look at, you know, schools, when they shut down for the summer, a lot of police agencies will then hold their trainings. And they hold the training where, you know, we've got one shooter, maybe a second shooter inside the school. They're going to be in classrooms. You're going to practice going into the classroom. We can't break the classroom doors, so we're not going to practice breaching. And then there's this constant element in training that there might be a second shooter somewhere else. There's been a second shooter 3 times in the last 30 years. So that's something that's extraordinarily rare. Most often, the shooter has fled, commit suicide, been subdued by people at the school or just surrendered before the first responding police officer even gets there. So I think part of it is building training around different scenarios, making sure that they're realistic, having things like kids running, kids screaming. When you look at the videos and the firsthand accounts of incidents, they're very quiet. Kids are taught to be quiet. At the Covenant School, it was completely quiet. At Uvalde, it was so quiet that the police officers assumed all the kids were out at recess or out in the cafeteria, that they saw dark rooms with no sound coming from them. If every single training that you're going to is screams being pumped in from every direction, then is your training putting you in the same mindset as the real world circumstances? So what I would like to see, and I think there's some really progressive agencies that are working on it already, is we have 220 attacks that have happened. Rather than imagining a scenario, pull one out of that stack. This is a real world circumstance. And they're not boring. They're across the board. There's everything from somebody firing 230 rounds at a school at dismissal from a fifth floor apartment building to an 11 and 12 year old kid hiding in the bushes with a dozen rifles and shooting kids when they're coming out when the fire alarm is going off, to attacks where the kids load up in the bathroom, come out of the bathroom firing. There's every possible scenario that you can imagine that's actually happened at a school. We don't need to get into the realm of making up scenarios, because that scenario might not actually fit anything.
Yeah, that would be an excellent addition to training if you could pull out of a stack and kind of go through that. Now, what's your take on, I know that some of the training can involve the students while they're there. And I've seen some research that has, you know, talked about, I think that, let me see what it was called. Yeah, like how dangerous school active shooter myths can increase in casualties by Michael Dorn in the school security and safety handout by Endeavor. And he talked about like some of the effectiveness of these safety measures in that maybe they were causing some trauma or stress to the children already if we're just running drills with the children. I was curious to maybe where you stood on that.
Yeah, they're two different really important elements about involving kids in the drills themselves. First, if it's younger kids and if it's a surprise drill that has high intensity elements in it, like somebody that has simunitions or flashbangs or whatever else, the really young kids aren't going to know the difference between that drill and an actual shooting. And I think that that's something where there have been some bills passed in different states to prevent, you know, those no notice high intensity drills. But even, you know, just talking to parents, talking to, you know, other researchers who are more focused on psychology and public health and pediatrics, is even without that high intensity in a no notice drill, young kids don't know the difference. Mm-hmm. And young kids will tell their parents, you know, we had a school shooting today. There was somebody, you know, here to shoot up the school today, but it was actually the drill where they were practicing. So that's the harmful psychological side of the drills. I think the more serious problem is when you start breaking down this data and you realize that your most common circumstance is an insider attack by a current student at the school. It means that they have been trained over and over in exactly what the procedures are. They know the password, they know where people are gonna go, they know that where the lines are on the floor, where students are gonna be behind this line. You know, they know the password to get inside a locked door. They know the secondary evacuation points. They know the points that the school isn't prepared for. You know, the shootings tend to happen in transition periods, like arrival at the school between classes, at lunchtime, at dismissal. They know that you've never practiced, that the kids aren't going to be in the classrooms. So you have to wonder, is it effective if you know that the most likely person to shoot up the school is a student? Do you really want all of the students to be learning what to do? Or is it something where just the teachers can all know the plan? Yeah. I also wonder at this point, you know, and this is from, you know, looking at all of these incidents, have we made it too complicated? You know, over the last 25 years since Columbine, lockdowns didn't exist before Columbine. A lot of the additional fortification didn't exist before Columbine. But since Columbine, there are more incidents, they're more frequent, and they're more deadly. So it, should people just be getting away from the building as quickly as possible? Then it can be as simple as you hear a fire alarm, you know there's a fire alarm, you know you leave. If you hear gunshots, you're going to leave even faster. So have we made this more complicated than it needs to be? And those kids in the classroom in Uvalde, they would have been better off leaving. There's no question that they would have been better off evacuating from that school. So when we come to these important milestones, and it's 25 years after Columbine next month, are we doing the right things, or are we actually making the problem worse?
Yeah, I think that is a heavy question, but I think it's an excellent question to ask, because we've had this problem for a long time. And I mean, I remember Columbine when I was in school. So it was something that, you know, kind of kicked off this increase in awareness of maybe the mental health of students and what it was leading to. But it was also something that it felt like over the last maybe 25 years, we've tried to stamp it, or we've tried to template it. And it is this problem that obviously we are looking at a symptom and not maybe a root cause to what is actually happening, because no matter the way that we go, or the thing that becomes the next trend to do for that industry in schools and that sort of thing, and dealing with that problem, it doesn't seem to help.
Well, this gets back to kind of the root of where the school shooting database came from. In 2018, if you couldn't say how many shootings had happened that year or that decade, why they happened, were they getting worse or better or more frequent? If you couldn't say that, what was all of this planning based on?
Yeah.
What were all of these different technologies and policies based on? And so I think that's a problem, that people had some assumptions that became institutionalized. Somebody said, if we lock the door and hide in the corner, that's going to be better. There was never any evidence that was going to happen. Nobody had thought about what the characteristics are of the attacks, that more than half of your single shooter insider attacks start and end in the same room. If they start and end in the same room, you have to get the people out of that room. And if you want people to be getting out of rooms, then you need different procedures. But yeah, it just comes down to there was never good data. There was never really careful analysis of this. And it takes a lot of time to change something once it becomes an institutional standard. And I think people across the security industry will understand that, you know, maybe the guy who's sitting on the stool with the uniform at the front of the jewelry store, you know, maybe he's going to help, maybe he's not. But once that became standard in the 70s, if you're a jewelry store, you have to do that. So you're constantly working against, I think, momentum in the security industry. And any time that you're suggesting to change a widespread and widely accepted practice, it's always going to be an uphill battle.
Yeah. And I think that's exactly, just from reading your data and from, you know, hearing you speak, that's exactly what it is an uphill battle. So I do have a question from your research and from the time that you've put into it. Do you have a hypothesis on why, kind of looking, I was looking at your Substack and at your chart that showed the timeline of, and it was a line graph, the timeline of school shootings. And it looks like there's that little bump in the 90s that we see, and then another bump in the mid-2000s, and then a drastic spike from about 2018. And maybe that's just because you started reporting on it. But a spike that came from 2018. What's your hypothesis there? Like, what is causing this to become more and more of an issue? And I'm sure it's multiple things, but I'd love to hear your take.
Yeah, it's two different things. So back to what I said a few minutes ago around there are planned deliberate attacks at schools, and then there are spontaneous shootings where person habitually carries a gun. They didn't plan to shoot somebody that day, but circumstances turn that direction. if you look at just the deliberate attacks since 1966, there are 1 to 3 a year, pretty much every year across that 60-year period. They're not really going up or down in frequency. So there have been people interested in harming people at the school. Most often they're students. Their community is the school. They have a grievance that's connected to that school. And as they spiral down this crisis, they decide that their only option is to commit the school shooting, and that's their final act. They don't have a second target. They don't have an escape plan. They often plan to commit suicide or die, or they know they're going to spend life in prison. That has been a constant through 60 years. You can pull one of those from 1974, and it'll line up exactly with something in 2017. You get exactly the same profile. What has changed in the last 6 years is the number of fights that are escalating into shootings at schools. And I've done extensive searches with a lot of different tools, and a lot of other researchers have used this data who also have studied gun violence during the 80s and 90s and 2000s. And people are not coming to me with missing incidents. So I believe that this is a pretty good picture of the shootings that have occurred, at least in the last 25 years. Things get spotty once you get earlier because it's all based on newspaper archives. But it's a pretty good picture of the last 25 years. And what's different since about 2021's coming out of the pandemic is fights between kids turning into shootings. And that's more armed teenagers habitually carrying guns to school than they did, you know, at any other point in history. I think that's a new and different problem.
Yeah, that's interesting. I wonder, do you think that the pandemic maybe fueled that in some way? Or is it?
We really won't know until 10 years from now when, you know, you can look back at different time periods. But all indications are that there's, you know, an adolescent mental health crisis, because having more than a year of virtual school and isolation during a really formative period has caused a lot of problems. There were also, you know, record gun sales and record gun thefts during that period. So, you know, a lot of these schools are in some of the most disadvantaged parts of the country. And the reality in those neighborhoods is that somebody of any age can get a stolen gun pretty easily. And in the suburbs and in rural areas, from a national survey that was done last year, more than half of firearms owners don't leave unsecured weapons in their house. And so an unsecured weapon in the house, kids are smart. They're going to know where it is. So if a kid wants to take a gun to school, they're going to know that it's at in their parents' house, in their relative's house, in their friend's relative house. So unsecured weapons can get into schools, and guns that are being sold on the streets can get into schools. And in both cases, it's not kids that want to kill as many people as possible. It's a fight that turns into usually a bystander getting shot. And for that kid, for that victim, I mean, is it that different to be shot by an indiscriminate shooter and have a life-changing injury versus, you know, to be shot as a bystander during the fight and have a life-changing injury? Really, the only difference is a GoFundMe and support and so on, because if it's one of those high-profile shootings, at least there's a victims fund and a lot of resources for the victims. But for, you know, more than 330 of the shootings last year that barely make local news, those kids and those families are going to deal with the consequences of those injuries pretty much on their own. So it's a sad situation.
Yeah, it is definitely a black eye to our society right now. And I feel like your information and your research and data is, you know, doing really well at kind of turning the spotlight on. It's getting warmed up. You know how like when you turn a spotlight on, it's kind of like dim for a second before that halogen kind of gets going. And then, so I really hope that information like this is getting out. That's why I wanted to have you on. But I also hope that, you know, communities and people in positions that can execute policy and that can, you know, start to change the narrative. And even in the mental health space, that if they can use this information to see trends or to see something that they can help address specifically between teens of, you know, 13 to 18, most likely male, like if we can be putting those things in place, then maybe we can curb this to some degree. I know that in the studies that you've been going over, you've talked about that 575-page DOJ report from Uvalde, and you kind of walked, you're walking through that still, or you've walked through that to make, and it's a roadmap to make schools safer is what they're saying, but can you detail a few things that you've seen from that report and maybe speak to your overall thoughts on it?
Yeah, for your audience, where, you know, a lot of folks are security integrators, they can actually have a role in one of the biggest recommendations in the DOJ report. And that was, you know, a lot of schools have technology-based solutions now for emergency alerting and for access control. And a lot of them are app-based. But there at Robb Elementary in Uvalde, they didn't have comprehensive and fast Wi-Fi in the whole building. And in lots and lots of schools, because they're brick and block construction, you don't have any cell service in the inside rooms of a building. So there in Uvalde, the emergency alert that went out that said, you know, campus lockdown, went to people's personal cell phones, to some people who didn't have Wi-Fi. And then the way that it was set up from that vendor is you would get a notification that said, emergency alert, you know, click and log in for more details. Well, in a critical incident, there's not going to be time for somebody to click and remember their password and log into the app. Hopefully they updated it. Hopefully they're not a substitute teacher who hasn't been in that school district for a minute and might not even have the app downloaded. So as an integrator can think about, does somebody have the network infrastructure they need? Does this school have the internal Wi-Fi infrastructure? Do we have a backup where, you know, if the internet goes down at the school, does it mean that nobody is getting any alerts, that nobody is able to use the access control system or the CCTV system? Those are questions that as you're looking at a school, you can help the administrators realize that, you know, you're about to spend $1 million on this technology. Let's also spend $10,000 to make sure that all the Wi-Fi routers are updated. You know, make sure that it's not somebody's personal cell phone service and personal cell phone that might be the only tool that they have to get critical information during an emergency. So that was one of the main recommendations in that DOJ report, is that you have to have redundancy and you have to have easy to use systems during high stress. And if you've been in a crazy situation, if you've been in a violent situation or had shots fired nearby, taking multiple, you know, motions to open up an app is going to be really, really difficult. So that's something to walk through with your clients. The other piece that was really important there is that with the lockdown procedures, there were students and teachers that were wounded and killed by bullets that went through the school walls, both interior walls into classrooms and exterior walls when the shooter started firing before they got inside. And that's, you know, I'm big on, you hear shots, get as far away as you can, as fast as you can. Whether you're at a school, a mall, a shopping center, a transit agency, a grocery store, shots are fired, get away. The best thing you can do is be as far away from a gun as possible if somebody's shooting. The kids that have been told to lock down followed that procedure and it didn't help them. So that's in the report. We got to think about if that's the right solution, if there are better ways. And with notification systems, with fire alarms, people have been successfully evacuating for decades. You know, can we use those lessons? Can we use those existing technologies? Can you enhance those technologies in different ways? Multi-zone fire alarms, maybe evacuate just this portion of the school. There are a lot of options out there. We just need to think beyond the constraints of these current institutionalized policies.
That information is so important. The things that you're saying, I feel like, need to be at the forefront of the mind of not just security integrators, but people who are designing these things from the beginning. I know that I'm you know, industry friends with a couple of people who have started and are continuing on through the Secure Building Council, trying to get a security certification in place for buildings at the very beginning that you can kind of stamp on the project. And I know that it's just so important that we're, with how much building is going on, that's what I'm thinking of right now, that we're designing these things, like the design would change for sure from this data. I know that we have to retrofit it back and change procedures and, like you were saying, change standards that the industry has set. But at least moving forward, this should change design like tomorrow, you know? And so...
Yeah, if I could make one recommendation for every school building in the entire country,
yes,
is that every single classroom has a secondary exit. And if every single classroom has a secondary exit, then everybody can get out really quickly when there's an emergency. There was a shooting a couple months ago in Serbia, and it was in a classroom that had a back door, and the student came in shooting, and almost everybody who wasn't hit got out of the back door. And it turned out that the shooter had a backpack with multiple Molotov cocktails, and he was planning to shoot some people and then toss the Molotov cocktail into the classroom. And so when you think about barricades, lockdowns, a lot of the one-way locks and different aftermarket door-closing devices and so on, mixing that with a Molotov cocktail is an absolute disaster. But the Oxford shooter, he had Molotov cocktails made at his house.
Yeah.
He just didn't have them with him because he wasn't planning to commit the shooting that day. Once he was taken into the counselor's office, he sped up the timeline and committed it that afternoon. But about half of the plots that I've looked at involved some secondary component, whether it's pipe bombs, explosives, flammable liquids, releasing toxic gases, releasing chemicals. And we just need to realize that this is bigger and more complex than any simple training scenario. And if you're not thinking about all of these things, you might put students into an even worse position.
Now, speaking of the Oxford, I'm glad you brought that up. I know that their parents were charged for the shooting. And so can you speak to that a bit? Is this a, like, from the now moving more to the, you know, legal side of things, is this a situation where they were extremely guilty, or is this a shift in how the courts are going to start seeing these issues? What do you think about that?
It's a shift for the courts, but this was probably the most egregious case that you could possibly imagine. The student was telling his parents that he needed help, that he was hearing voices, that he was suicidal, that he wanted to hurt himself, that he wanted to hurt other people. There were just pictures released during the father's trial 2 weeks ago of his bedroom. And this is a 15-year-old teenager. And the only thing on the wall of his bedroom was the human targets from shooting with his family. And the only book and thing in the bedroom was his journal, where he had written dozens of pages about his attack plan. And it's sitting right there on his desk. And then there are loose firearms and ammunition throughout the house, amid somebody saying, "I want to hurt people. I want to hurt myself. I want to hurt others." If all of that wasn't bad enough, then that morning of the shooting, the parents are called into the counselor's office because a teacher saw him drawing a picture of a school shooting on his math test. And so there in the counselor's office, the counselor asks the parents, "Is there any chance he has access to a gun?" And they say no, even though there's a gun in his backpack, and they know it's probably in his backpack. The counselor says, "It's probably best for you to take him home." And they said, "No, we're not going to do that." And then the counselor also really messed up the situation by not recognizing the severity of the circumstances, by not looking in the bag, by not getting another adult to help as well. But the parents in this case, they had every single opportunity to know there was a problem. They decided to buy a gun and give open access to that gun to a teenager who's saying he wants to hurt people. And then at this last possible moment where an adult is telling them, like, "Please take him home. Like, we don't want him to be in the school today," they still refused. And that's why they're in jail. That's having a very active role in in enabling that attack to happen.
Yeah, well, that's I'm glad that they landed on that. I hope that people are... So one thing that I feel like people that we can do to kind of shift the landscape is just be more attentive to those in our lives and what they're doing and how they're feeling and be open in communication. And if there are things that we see, then we can help them either try to get help voluntarily or we can report that in some way, shape, or form. So
Listen to somebody who's asking for help. Listen to somebody, especially a teenager, who's saying that they want to hurt themselves or others.
Yeah.
And then just in general, if you have firearms in your house, keep them locked and secured. Because even if your kids are fine, it might be somebody who breaks into the house. And then those are some stolen guns that end up being sold on the streets and end up in an inner city school. That might be the friend who is having problems, whose parents aren't paying attention, that you don't know about, but knows that there's access to guns in your house, that ends up breaking in and taking them. Or in the case of the 11 and 12 year old kid who committed the planned attack in Jonesboro, they knew that they had two elderly grandparents where the grandfather was in really bad shape. The grandmother was, in really bad shape. They weren't going to be able to watch and police what was going on around their house. Mm-hmm. So they slowly took the guns from that house where they weren't secured because the adults there weren't competent to be keeping track of them. So keep track of elderly family members too.
Yeah, definitely.
It's help other people, and it's a bipartisan issue. Nobody wants a six-year-old to shoot their teacher.
Yeah.
Nobody wants 11 and 12-year-old kids to be able to commit a planned attack at a school. Nobody wants in Columbia last year, a 12-year-old kid killed another 12-year-old kid in the hallway.
Yeah.
Like, nobody wants those things. So let's make the common sense steps to help people in crisis and to make sure that they don't have access to a weapon when they want to hurt somebody.
100%. So I know we're at the top of our hour, but I do have one final question just to kind of follow the framework of this segment is where do you feel like this is going in the next 3 to 5 years and maybe in the next decade, just from the data? And you said that we would need more data to understand exactly what's happening, but where do you feel like this is going as a thing?
Yeah, 5 or 10 years, we'll be able to see if the pandemic caused just a short-term issue where there were a lot of kids that had significant social and developmental issues from that isolation. And that's resulted in a couple year period where when they're in adolescence and they're able to access guns, that they're having fights that escalate into shootings. If that's just a bubble after the pandemic, we'll grow out of that. And hopefully things would return back to the pre-pandemic kind of characteristics of gun violence. If it's actually a pattern where, it continues to grow and escalate, right now there's a shooting at a school almost every day of the year, sometimes two or three different shootings at different schools around the country. Those are the fights that escalate. So there's no limit on how high that number could go. There are 130,000 schools with 60 million kids. So if that pattern of more kids carrying guns getting into fights, like there could be 1,000 incidents in a year. Like there could be 10,000. There's no ceiling on the amount of conflict there can be. So unfortunately, we're going to see whether this was a post-pandemic bubble that corrects or whether it's a new pattern of teenagers who think that guns are the answer for their conflict. And unfortunately, going back to 1966, there have been, 1 to 3 planned attacks that have happened at schools every year. And that will probably continue for the foreseeable future.
Well, I really appreciate you coming on the podcast. Thank you so much for being willing to talk about this. I think that it needs to be a conversation that we're talking about. And so can you just tell people how to get a hold of you or, how to see your work again one more time so that anybody listening knows how they can reach out?
Yeah, it's the K-12 school shooting database. It's K-12-SSDB on all of the different social media platforms. It's K-12-SSDB.org on that site, it has links to Substack, links to media, links to social media. Find me on LinkedIn, David Reedman. Send me messages. I respond to as many as I can. There's a contact us form on the website. I try to respond to everybody's email on that. Unfortunately, whenever a plant attack happens, that inbox goes from my perpetual 50 unanswered messages to like 1,000, but I try to work back through them. Especially anybody who's involved directly in school safety, somebody who's a teacher, a parent, when they have a question, I want to answer them because those are the people that are going to make a change at their individual community level, at their individual school level, because you really can do that. If you pay attention to people in crisis, if you keep your firearms secured, you can make sure that there's really not going to be a shooting in your community.
Awesome. Well, David, thanks so much. I'm proud to see humans, you know, like you doing this work. I encourage you to keep doing it. I really think that this is going to make a change, especially with all the work you put in and all the work that you will put in the future. So thanks for coming on, man. And hopefully we'll have you on again to talk about maybe a specific niche or something like that within this realm of very complicated things, as we can see here today. But thanks again for coming on, man, and we'll see you next time.
No problem. Thank you. Take care.
Bye. Hey, Security Today fans and listeners. We just listened to David Reedman talk about his K-12 database that he runs on school shooting data and research. So I wanted to take a second to just step back because the episode itself is pretty heady. It talks about a lot of things. We go into details, we go into ideas and concerns from the scope of it all. But I wanted to take a second on the back end of this and look at it from the integrator's perspective and the integrator's point of view. You saw that he talked about how, as an integrator, we hold a pretty important job. And I want that importance to just resonate with you as you work this week. We are doing things when we are out there to help mitigate and save lives in emergency moments and in violent public moments. So there's a couple things that we can do. And you heard him talk about the Uvalde report. And in the Uvalde report, the DOJ, they recommended that the Wi-Fi and networked infrastructure is good in the schools so that it can handle the traffic and the emergency alerts. Please, for the love of God, do not sell an emergency alert system that when there's an emergency, they have to log in to see the details. That was pretty remarkable to me, and I would feel haunted if I was the security integrator that put that in. That is not the time that you need to be proving yourself or proving identification. You need the details to what's going on. And so there's just ways that we can come about it. And it is a multi-layer approach. We talk about defense in depth. We talk about security theory, where we build concentric rings from the assets out. And that means that we're going to be putting in things like gun detection, visual and audio. That means that we're going to putting CCTV that's covering the entire campus. And do note that he said that 70% of school shootings happen outside, okay? We've talked about that on podcasts before for news and highlights when covering this area. So that outside coverage is ideal and is critical to the emergency and how it progresses and how it is mitigated and how it ends. It's like a business continuity plan, but it is your emergency continuity plan to make sure that you can, you know, get the data to them and you can stay up and make sure that the kids are feeling safe and taken care of that were involved in it. And man, from a design standpoint, I loved that he pointed out that if we're going forward into the future, we should be designing 2 exits in every single room. That is just an emergency protocol. Taking a mindset from a fire alarm or some sort of environmental disaster within the school, the procedures and policies that are put in place say that you are to flee, to get out. And I think that that's something that we should consider when going ahead. But as a security integrator, what we need to be doing is making sure that when we're in these situations, we take them very seriously. And it's not just these situations. If we're putting security cameras or access control on, let's say, a small vet hospital, or we're putting security cameras into a grocery store. We need to be taking these things as serious as if we're putting security measures into schools, so that we are, you know, so that we're taking care of children's lives. That we need to see that in everything that we do. Because here's the thing: is there going to be an extreme security incident at a vet hospital? Maybe not. But if we were serious when we did that, if that so arises, we've put in measures and things into place that are going to help mitigate that and help the situation as a whole. And we also got the practice. Okay, every time you're putting security into a place, every time you're integrating security or putting a mag lock on a door, if you do it with the seriousness and the importance that I urge you to take your role in society and in life, then you're just practicing every single time, which means in the moments that you have to guard or secure something as precious as a child's life, you're going to not fail or falter. You're not going to be swooned by a dollar sign or you know, some Chinese tech that's easy to put in, or some emergency response system that needs you to log in to get details. So please take it seriously as you're out there. This is more of a somber attitude just because of the episode, and I know I preach it in a much more flamboyant way in my news and highlights, but we need to be seeing the security integrator as important in society, the security designer, the security engineer, as important as the doctors, the police officers, you know, the people that are taking care of the issues right of bang. We are taking care of the issues left of bang. And if anything, this episode is an excellent display and example of how preparation and the things on the front end sometimes really fucking matter, okay? So please, take it as that serious and share this. Share this episode, please, please, please. I need policymakers. I need people who are in charge, who are making policy, who are making standards, who are out there pushing procedures in their companies as, you know, the C-suite individuals. I need them to see this, because we need to be taking it this serious in everything that we do. So I hope you have a good day. I hope things like this are really helping to be the better tech, to think beyond yourself, beyond your career, to really make this something that you're working on. I will see you next time on the Security Today podcast.